solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
For example, my research shows that over a third of the purchases people make on Amazon originate from algorithmic recommendations. Over 80% of viewing activity on Netflix and over 70% of the time people spend on YouTube is driven by algorithms. You know, Deepak, you were in recruiting. Recruiting is using a lot of algorithms to screen resumes and figure out which applicants to invite for job interviews. And they're also being used in, medicine. Doctors are consulting algorithms to make personalized treatment decisions. In courtrooms in the U.S., you have algorithms being used to guide judges on sentencing decisions. We're working on driverless cars. So the stakes are just getting higher and higher.
Welcome to the 44th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders during high-stakes transition, whether it's related to their organization or their career. I feel just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win, in the context of their business strategy. We all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. I work with leaders to address those two questions, especially during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, and so on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm excited to talk about my next guest on the podcast, Karthik Hosanagar. Karthik is the John C. Hauer Professor of Technology and Digital Business and a Professor of Marketing of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He holds the distinction of being the first guest to appear for the second time on this podcast. Our first conversation with him was about his journey, thoughts on entrepreneurship, and perspectives on academics as a career path. His book, Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, published by Penguin Random House, has just been launched in India, and I caught up with him this time in that context. Given the pervasiveness of AI in our lives, and given the exponentiality of it and how it could impact the future of the world we inhabit, I felt it would be a great opportunity to sit with him to understand how he thinks about the various elements of AI, the challenges, the opportunity, the trade-offs involved, and how we think about staying relevant and reflect about preparing ourselves and our children for the future, which might look and feel very different from what it is today. Before we dive into the conversation with Karthik, a quick heads up on what's in store in the coming weeks. I recently caught up with Michael Watkins, one of the leading global authorities in the space of leadership transition acceleration, and will be publishing that conversation in a couple of weeks. We spoke at length about how leaders can effectively settle into a new context and how the strategy needs to vary significantly depending on the specific context of the transition. Now, let's get back to AI and jump straight in to the conversation with Karthik Hosanagar.
Karthik, thank you so much for making the time to come on the podcast.
Deepak, thanks for having me. It's the second time on your podcast. I'm really thrilled you had me back.
Absolutely. You're the first person with that distinction. So thank you for reappearing on the podcast. And congratulations on the launch of the book in the US, Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence.
Thank you very much.
How's the book doing?
Yeah, it's doing well. It's been a good 1 month since the book has launched. And, there's been a good amount of interest in this topic. Not very surprisingly, because I think AI and algorithms have such impact on our lives. There's a lot of interest, whether it's from lay consumers or from execs in corporations. So a lot of interest. There's been a lot of media coverage. There's been opinion pieces in New York Times, interviews in CNBC, Bloomberg, and excerpts in Wired and Fast Company, and lots of radio interviews and so on. So it's been nice to get the word out to more people. You know, you spend 2 years writing, it's nice to finally have readers for the book.
And look forward to laying my hands on it in India when it gets launched.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited about the India launch.
Let's go back to the basics, Karthik. Why don't we start with just understanding the definition of machine intelligence? What do you have in mind? And also, why write this book and why now?
Yeah, sure. So artificial intelligence or machine intelligence is the idea of getting computers to do the kinds of things that takes human intelligence. For example, understand language, navigate the physical world, meaning pick up objects, manipulate objects, recognize people, recognize things in the visual world, reason, learn, all those kinds of things. So that's artificial intelligence. And a subfield of artificial intelligence is machine learning, which gets a lot of attention recently. And it's focused on how do you get machines to learn from data. And arguably, it's the most important subfield of AI, because if you have a system that can learn faster than us, but it's very basic at the beginning, it won't take a long time for that system to catch up with us. On the other hand, you have a system that's got all our knowledge, but it cannot learn. It takes only a day for us to leave it behind. So machine learning is arguably the most important subfield of AI. And you know why I wrote this book is because AI and machine learning are entering into all kinds of technology that we touch today. And most of these technologies have underlying algorithms in them. And so these algorithms, essentially for people who don't know, an algorithm is simply a glorified term for a series of steps one follows to get something done. So any software you use, it follows a set of steps to do what it's doing. Like Amazon makes product recommendations. People who bought this also bought this. That is its recommendation algorithm. And so any software has algorithms. These algorithms are becoming more intelligent. More AI is coming into them. And they are also making more and more decisions for us. And so I think we should care about it. And people don't understand how much of an impact they have on decisions we make. For example, my research shows that over a third of the purchases people make on Amazon originate from algorithmic recommendations. Over 80% of viewing activity on Netflix and over 70% of the time people spend on YouTube is driven by algorithms. You know, Deepak, you were in recruiting. Recruiting is using a lot of algorithms to screen resumes and figure out which applicants to invite for job interviews. And they're also being used in, medicine. Doctors are consulting algorithms to make personalized treatment decisions. In courtrooms in the US, you have algorithms being used to guide judges on sentencing decisions. We're working on driverless cars. So the stakes are just getting higher and higher.
Hmm. And going back to an earlier conversation I had on this podcast, Karthik, with the chess legend Vishwanathan Anand, I'd asked him about his thoughts on the role of humans in a world where the machines are getting smarter by the day. Mm. And given Deep Blue beat Kasparov some time back, what he said was interesting. He spoke about a version of chess called advanced chess, started by Garry Kasparov.
Mm.
And it's a bit like an open book exam where you can refer a computer for a move and then play what you want.
Yeah.
But then he went on to say that, you know, a man plus machine versus man plus machine very soon became machine versus machine. So I guess he was making the point that, when you got two smart machines playing each other, there was limited value that a human could add in the middle. So I guess a philosophical question is, how do you see the role of humans in a world where the machines are getting smarter exponentially by the day?
Right. So that's really interesting. So I think some of the studies have shown that man plus machine beats man and it beats machine. So it seems like there is some role for man to play. But I agree with, obviously a huge chess legend, Vishwanathan Anand is saying, which is that eventually the role of humans is going to diminish in something like that. And with more and more activities around us, it's going to be the case that for a long period of time, man plus machine will beat both man and machine. And it will be the case that machine will beat man, But then man plus machine will beat machine. But then eventually, as machines advance, the role of the human diminishes. So I think as we move towards what is known as artificial general intelligence, which is this idea that AI can be generally intelligent like us, not at very narrow tasks. Like, you know, you have a system like Deep Blue, or more recently Leela Zero or Alpha Zero, which play chess, which can beat humans at chess, but they can't treat diseases, they cannot understand language and so on. But as we move towards artificial general intelligence, which is systems that are generally intelligent like us, I think our role will diminish. And, you know, there'll be a lot of questions that we'll have to answer about what is work, you know, how do we engage with meaningful work, and so on. I think this idea of, you know, jobs or roles which require compassion, which require a human touch, which require personalization. I mean, you do something that is very interesting, which is personalized exec coaching. So that's, I think these are the kinds of things, or you look at what a doctor and a nurse does, you can automate a lot of things they do, like diagnose diseases, maybe even figure out the right treatment options. But I think for a patient, the value of speaking to a doctor or have a nurse right there, talk to them, those things are, you know, hard to sort of quantify and replace. And so I think some of those kinds of roles will be ones that will become more important.
And do you see, maybe just picking on one of the things you said, artificial general intelligence, what do you, how do you see the curve there? And do you see a certain point of singularity where things, the dynamic completely shifts?
Yeah, so the point of singularity would be the point where the system is as intelligent than us, but then it has more processing power than us and can handle more data than us. So it will leave us behind in no time. And once we get there, then you could as well ask, you know, what's the point of humans doing anything? Because let's say you wanted to come up with a cure for cancer, but why even try? Because this system can process data faster than you, is, you know, super intelligent. So it'll beat you to it. And clearly that is a very interesting and both promising and scary scenario. In terms of your point on when this might happen, you know, we can only speculate. There was a survey that was done, I believe, by author Nick Bostrom, where he asked some of the leading AI researchers on when singularity or when superintelligence might, when might we hit that. And the survey, you know, the vast majority of the leading AI researchers who were surveyed gave a projection in the 25 to 75 years range. Now, I personally don't subscribe to 25 years, but let's say you go with the high end of the range, 75 years, or you even say 100, 150 years, that's not that far. And so I think we have to start thinking today in terms of how we prepare for those kinds of scenarios.
Got it. And moving to another game like chess, you talk extensively about the movie, about the game Alpha as well. AlphaGo. And specifically, you refer to a particular game where a 37th move got everybody puzzled. And you, in that context, you also talk about the notion of predictability resilience paradox. So talk to our listeners about what's this paradox and what does this mean in terms of how we think about AI systems, and what does it mean and what is the implication for various stakeholders here?
Yeah, so the story I mentioned in the book is about this system Google's DeepMind division created called AlphaGo, and it was all over the news, so most of your listeners have likely heard of it. But just to set context, Go is a strategy game like chess, but far more complex than chess. There's many more moves that one could explore, and so it's hard to conquer Go with just brute computational power, unlike chess, which you can conquer with brute computational power. And so Go was this one game where humans were beating machines for quite some time. But that changed with AlphaGo, which beat the World Go champion, Lee Sedol. And I describe one particular game in which Go made a move which was very unexpected. That game was, you know, going like any other game for a while. It seemed like AlphaGo had an advantage over Lee Sedol, who was the Go world champion. But then all of a sudden, AlphaGo made a move, which was the move number 37, which stumped a lot of people. And, you know, I recollect the European Go champion saying, this is not a human move. And in fact, Lee Sedol had to step out of the room and come back, and he slowed down and he was trying to make sense of the move. And initially, some people even thought that's a poor move, a bad move. And it turned out that it was a brilliant move. And it's not a move that humans would make. And some people called it a move from an alternative dimension. So it kind of brings up this question of, you know, where is this ability to go beyond human kinds of moves coming in? And I use that to set up this idea that I refer to as predictability resilience paradox, which is a paradox I mention in the context of designing algorithms. And I make the case that it's hard to build an algorithm that is simultaneously highly predictable and highly resilient. And so let me clarify what I mean by that. So if you wanted to build an AI system to do something amazing, like drive a car or diagnose diseases, there's many ways in which to build that sort of system. It used to be the case that the old way of doing this was that you interviewed experts, like a let's say I want to build a system to diagnose diseases. I would interview lots of doctors over several hours and ask them what are the rules they use to diagnose a disease, or what are the rules they use to interpret an X-ray image, or whatever it is. And they give me the rules and I code those rules. It turns out you can build reasonably good AI systems with that, but they ultimately cannot match human intelligence. They are subpar as far as humans are concerned. That's because we have a lot of knowledge that we cannot even, that we don't even know we have. So it's hard to even share that knowledge or share the rules associated with that. For example, if I asked you, Deepak, you know, give me the rules to identify your mother's face in a photograph, you can give me a bunch of rules like the shape of her eye, the color of her eye, the shape of her nose, hair, and so on. But I code all those rules, that software will fail with the very first photograph I give it, because there's a lot of knowledge you have which you're not even able to express. You're not even aware of that knowledge. And so the question is there a better way to build AI? And the better way to build AI over the last 10, 15 years has turned out to be machine learning, which is the idea that instead of asking experts for rules, let's observe them in action, let's collect that data and ask the machine to find patterns. So instead of asking doctors to give us the rules for diagnosing diseases, we observe maybe a million, you know, or a crore patients coming into hospitals. And we observe what were their complaints, what were their symptoms, what were their clinical markers, and what was the final diagnosis by the doctor. And we give that data to a statistical system or a machine that observes the pattern and learns how to diagnose disease. And that's how now we're building systems that can match humans in terms of diagnosis. We're building systems that can drive cars on their own, because nobody has to give the system every rule it has to follow. It just observes, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people driving and learns how to drive with that. But the flip side of this is these systems are highly capable. They can beat humans. They can match humans. They're highly resilient as well. When they face a new situation, they might fail, but they immediately learn from that. They use the data and they improve. And so they're highly resilient, but then they're not highly predictable. The old rule-based systems, the expert systems, were highly predictable because they followed a fixed set of rules. You could say what it will do under any scenario because you programmed those rules. But these new systems, while they're more resilient, they're not highly predictable because, you know, you didn't code the rules. So it's all based on the data and how it's learning.
That's the 37th move, I guess, right?
That's the 37th move. And sometimes the data might not even be data on human moves. So AlphaGo was trained on moves made by Go champions in the past, but it also played millions of games on its own through simulations and against itself. So it's generating its own data and it's trying crazy moves and seeing what happens, and it's learning that here's a crazy move. No human has tried, but it seems to work. So I'm going to use it next time.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This insight from Karthik Hosanagar reminded me of something that came up in a very different context in my podcast with my guest Arun Myra. He's the ex-chairman of BCG India, an ex-member of the Planning Commission. I was talking to him about his book on listening, and I asked him about the art of framing a good question.
We look at data, and so there is a lot of questions about the data. Where's the data? How does the data add up? So you go down that path about the data and trying to see reality through reorganizing and adding up or subtracting in the data itself. And you can go down that path also into the logic behind in the data itself. Right. Yeah, so this weight will lead to that. So it comes to the next level of maths, which is not just addition and subtractions, but you go to more, you know, calculus maths. And so there's a whole way of thinking about how to make sense of the data. And I say, fine. Now the data is being interpreted by a mind. The data also is collected by people who felt that that was good data to get. So there was a mind which chose what data to select. So there are minds here. So there's a reasoning in the mind about why this is important data. So I learned to switch myself off the deductive track pretty quickly and to ask, why do you think one should be looking at this data? And then I would notice quite often that the why that person thinks this data is important is the reason probably I asked the question, because I think it's, what's the point of this data? I don't think this data is important, but this person is, you know, presenting all this stuff. Why do you think it's important? So I'm learning about another person's way of thinking and what another person gives value to, which apparently is not what I give value to, and it's not my way of thinking. So this is how I'm, people not like us, as I say, I'm listening to someone who's not like me.
Just like the 37th move of AlphaGo surprised a lot of experts, I find that we often get surprised by certain behaviors of others, but we end up seeing them from our perspective. The first challenge is to put ourselves in their shoes and see the world the way they see it, and then develop a view on the issue at hand. If you want to know more about the art of listening, you might find my conversation with Arun Myra of value. This particular snippet was from Nugget 34.01. If you find the podcast purposeful, you might want to consider doing three things. You could share it with people that you think could find this of value. You could sign up for the podcast so that you get mailers whenever we upload new content. You could rate and review the show on the platform on which you end up consuming the content. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Karthik Hosanagar.
So maybe just picking on that, Karthik, so how should we think about the trade-off of predictability versus resilience? And you also, in that context, talk about the contrast between the US Constitution and the Code of Hammurabi. I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yeah, so I kind of bring up this question in the book, which is called A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. And in that book, I bring up this question, should we go with predictability? Should we prefer resilience over predictability? What is it? How do we make this trade-off? And the contrast I bring up is that one analogy for that is if you look at rule systems that humans have used. One of the oldest rule systems we know of that society has used is the Code of Hammurabi, which we've all read about in history books when we were in, was it middle school or high school? And the Code of Hammurabi obviously has some of these very famous maxims like, eye for an eye, things like that. And it's very precise set of rules, which in modern times actually seem sometimes cruel, things like eye for an eye, but even outdated, because there are certain rules for what happens when your neighbor doesn't maintain their dam well and the water flows over from their field to your field and so on, and which isn't relevant to a lot of us today. And the point being that the Code of Hammurabi follows a fixed set of rules. It's highly predictable, but it's not resilient, because as times changed, and human civilization changed, it couldn't adapt and be relevant there. The US Constitution, interestingly, is again a set of rules that is used to govern in the US. It's one of the oldest constitutions that are still being used today. And the reason it's still successful and still being used today is because the Constitution is not a fixed set of rules. The Constitution allows for new cases to set a precedent for the Constitution to be amended, for new situations to arise and to set a precedent for, you know, Supreme Court, for the Constitution itself and so on. And so it adapts, and that has allowed it to survive longer. And so clearly, if you want an AI system to function in the long run, then you need to allow it to adapt as the environment is changing. And so that's why we are moving in the direction of machine learning over predictable expert systems. Even though these systems are a bit unpredictable, they can actually deliver, they can perform well, and they can adapt. And so that's one of the trends that I think will stay, that we'll see this switch towards machine learning. But the question arises, okay, we want machine learning because it's highly resilient, but how do we build some checks and balances to make sure it doesn't go out of control? And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a bit.
Absolutely. And going back to the point you made about the difference between expert systems and machine learning systems, where you need to expose them to a lot of data, I guess from a consumer's perspective, given each company is in the process of opening up a hose pipe into our lives, if I may use the term, and guzzling data for their models to come up the learning curve, how should we as consumers deal with multiple people injecting their pipes into our bodies? How should we think about convenience versus privacy here?
Yeah, so especially when we talk about algorithms that serve consumers, you know, meaning the algorithms most of us see in our lives, whether it's Google's personalized search results or Amazon's personalized recommendations or Facebook showing ads, all of these systems. At the end of the day, the machine learning relies on data. And so these companies are greedy for our data as a result. And how do we look at that trade-off? I think there's no doubt that these algorithms that are making decisions based on our data add a lot of value. The ability to find a video that's of interest to you on YouTube within, you know, 5 seconds, you know, versus searching and searching and finding the right kind of video, or Amazon saying, you know, people who viewed this eventually bought that product. These are all incredibly valuable.
Right.
The flip side, as you mentioned, is the privacy concern. The way I think of it is that a couple things. The first is, I think we need to be less passive in terms of how we use technology. We need to be more deliberate in terms of asking, how is the technology changing decisions I'm making? What is the technology trying to learn about me? What are they doing with that data? And I think we just need to not treat the technology as a black box. So I think we all need to get educated a little more about how all this works. And secondly, I think we also should ask for certain protections and demand certain protections from these companies and certain information. So in the book, I've kind of mentioned a few things. Just knowing, you know, how are these companies using our data? What do they do with it? You know, can we access the data? Can we ask them to delete it? These are important things that we should demand. And when we demand it, changes do happen. Like, look at Facebook's recent announcement where Zuckerberg said that they're going to start encrypting messages in the near future. And they will also create this feature where you can let your message kind of disappear after some period of time, so that a message you posted 10, 20 years back doesn't come back to haunt you later in life. And so I think those are features that they're launching, not because regulation forced them to, but because ultimately there's been a lot of pressure from their users over the last year or two. And so I think it really comes down to, let's use these systems because they offer a lot of value, but let's make sure we understand what they're doing with our data, and let's push back when needed. And when we do that collectively, I think there are actions taken. Also, I think we should ask for some good regulation in this space. Not over-regulate the sector, but ask for some good sense regulation, which also means that we need to elect people who are savvy about technology, who are able to push for the right kinds of technology regulations as well.
And what are some of the, maybe double-clicking on that, what are some of the headline themes around the kinds of regulations you have in mind?
Yeah, so if you look at the set of issues here, you could talk about issues related to privacy, which have been around for some time, and issues related to automated decisions or algorithmic decisions, which is a newer issue that's come up. So if we look at the first one, which is privacy, there has been increasing regulatory interest there. Europe passed a regulation known as GDPR, which I believe was a bit too excessive. There's a lot of compliance requirements that companies have to meet. But it also raised awareness of the privacy issues, and it created several changes that companies made in order to comply with GDPR. And in fact, in the US, the state of California passed a lighter version of GDPR, which I like more. And it's got several interesting provisions in there. For example, the ability to inspect and ask companies what they know about us, the ability to ask them to delete certain information. So today, you know, on Google, for example, you can go in and check what Google knows about you. And Google has to share what it knows about you. And you can also uncheck certain information that Google knows about you and say, okay, forget that you know about this. So you can ask, there's a right to delete in the regulation. There's also lots of provisions about things like what they can share, with whom they can share, and so on. And so I think these are important issues for all of us to look at. And it's fairly easy to find on Google, on Facebook, all of these platforms. Not many people are aware, so not many people even use this. So I think these are some of the issues that I'd kind of mention.
Got it. The other piece I want to get to, Karthik, is you speak about the FANGs, right? Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google. Mm-hmm. They are curating the world for us, given the data they have about us, and possibly not giving us the entire spread. And you talk about whether we are in control of our lives. And this goes back to the echo chamber discussion, right? And it's sort of quite timely because it's Indian election time. And this came up even during the last US elections. Mm-hmm. So I guess this we talk a lot about diversity of thought in leadership teams and in boardrooms. But how do we drive diversity of thought in the living room? You know, how should we think about, you know, the efficiency of an algorithm giving us what we want, what we're likely to want, versus opening up our minds to newer ideas?
Right. I think that issue becomes particularly relevant in political news content, as you were mentioning, elections and so on, where people's opinions are being shaped by the information they consume on digital platforms. I think there are aspects that are related to algorithms and there are aspects that go beyond algorithms. Let me start with the algorithmic portion. Certainly, if you look at platforms like Facebook, mm-hmm. there's a newsfeed algorithm that is trying to figure out what kinds of news posts you will engage with and what to show you. At any given point you log into Facebook, there are thousands of different posts that Facebook could show you. And it's based on your past engagement with what kinds of, you know, which of your friends' posts do you engage with? What topics do you engage with? All of that feeds into an algorithm that decides what to actually show you. And there is no doubt that there is an echo chamber there, that we tend to see more and more of what we already engage with. And so that diversity of thought might be stifled when the algorithms are trying to personalize our experience. I think the algorithm clearly is trying to maximize engagement and is going to show you the stuff that you will demonstrably engage with. And so that's not surprising. But I think there are things that we all could do. I think certainly it is, you know, everyone has seen or heard of situations where, you know, a friend posts something on Facebook which you disagree with, And what happens sometimes is people unfriend the other person. And if we start doing that, then I think that diversity of thought goes away. And it's sometimes important to get exposed to other viewpoints. Similarly, you know, people don't engage or click on content that shares a different perspective. So I think it's important for all, us all to try and make sure we get out of this filter bubble that the algorithms put us in. And sometimes we cause it ourselves by unfriending people who have a different viewpoint or not engaging with their posts or content. And that becomes pretty important. So one of the things that I did after this happened during the 2016 election in the US was I started, you know, I usually used to go to two news sites, New York Times and Times of India, to consume my news. And now I've increased that set to about 5-6 news sites. You know, so I'm looking at news stories from that are right-leaning, that are left-leaning, that are more moderate, to just get other perspectives. And I think it's important to try and do that. And then, of course, there are things, like I said, that's beyond the algorithm. Things like, you know, on WhatsApp. You know, there's so much fake news circulating on WhatsApp. And most of it is not because an algorithm is saying, hey, this is what you should see, but a friend of yours on some group in WhatsApp circulated the news. And mostly it's people not verifying the truthfulness of what they're sharing, and they consume it, and sensational stories get shared more and more. And so there's actually research studies that show that the top fake news stories are circulated more and seen by more people than the top true news stories, because the fake news stories are more sensational, and so people share it more and more. And that's a huge problem for democracy itself, because we are making voting decisions on information that is just baseless. And so I think we need to also have growing awareness that the internet is not like the newspaper. The newspaper has editors, has a curation process. And even that process leads to accusations of bias. But you think about the internet, it's people can put whatever they want over there. So we just need to also wake up and be more savvy when we see something sensational. Just go outside, go to a browser, verify the truthfulness of the information before you circulate it. Those kinds of things are important. So all of these steps are important in terms of making sure we have a diversity of perspectives, but also truth in those perspectives.
Got it. And moving to a different theme in the book, Karthik, you talk about a likelihood of unanticipated consequences in the world of AI. And you speak about the initial momentum in a certain direction suddenly can snowball into an avalanche. And you also quote, I found the metaphor of the cobra effect interesting in this context. So could you talk to the listeners about the insight here?
Yeah, sure. So the cobra effect is an interesting effect where we don't know the exact details of this, but legend has it that way back during British rule in India, specifically in Delhi, one of the governors there wanted to get rid of what he perceived as a cobra menace. There were just too many cobras, and therefore the government announced a bounty for anyone who catches or brings a cobra head. And so the idea was this would result in hunting of cobras or snakes and would ultimately help bring down the population. Now, initially, it seemed to bring in lots of people who would come in and produce cobras and collect the bounty. But the legend has it that what was happening was that once people realized that there's a bounty if you bring in cobras, they started breeding cobras. And they started breeding these and bringing it in and collecting the money. And so it wasn't really addressing the problem. And in fact, when the government realized it and then said the bounty is no longer available, people just released whatever they were breeding into the wild, making the problem worse. So it was one of those situations where there was a perverse outcome awaiting this person. And essentially what I call unanticipated consequences. You thought what this would do is reduce the cobra population, but the unanticipated consequence was that it actually might have increased the cobra population. And I bring that up because this notion of unanticipated consequences has been around in sociology for a while. And certainly with a lot of human decisions, we know these things happen where you intend to fix something and you make it worse by your intervention. And there's many examples of, you know, where this has happened. And when it comes to algorithmic decisions, again, we have to worry about the same thing, that sometimes you bring in an algorithm to fix something. And if you're not careful, it can make that worse. And because it's automated decisions, it can make it worse very fast. And there are many examples of this. So late last year, there was a news story about Amazon using recruiting algorithms. And the news story essentially kind of was talking about the fact that Amazon, you know, hired over 100,000 people last year, probably got millions of job applications. It's hard for a team of human recruiters to sift through that many resumes and figure out who to invite for job interviews. So they wanted to automate that process. And they looked at previous data on what kinds of applicants did well in interviews, what kinds of applicants did well at Amazon and got promoted after they joined. And they essentially used that as training data for a machine learning system that did the resume screening. Now, according to that Reuters news story, it turns out the internal investigation later showed that this AI system had big gender biases. And it had gender biases because, you know, if you think about it, the training data is decisions made by humans on who to promote, who to give offers to. And if there's a gender bias in those decisions, those biases get captured by the AI system and it learns it and it almost institutionalizes that bias. Now, fortunately, Amazon detected it. It's a savvy tech company, and so it detected it and stopped using the system. But there's many companies using these kinds of systems who are not as savvy as Amazon, not running these tests. And there's other examples. You know, ultimately, these AI systems are making decisions based on data. And so if there are problems in the data, they pick them up and then it snowballs and could go out of control. There was a study that showed that algorithms used in courtrooms in the US to make sentencing decisions, the ones used in Florida, had a race bias. And these race biases were probably because of biases in the data itself. There are many other settings. You know, there are examples of biases in the autocomplete suggestions that Google makes. And again, the Google autocomplete suggestions are based on search queries people are typing. And so it picks up some of their biases as well. And so there's many examples where some of these problems may go out of control if you're not careful. A classic example, one that I mentioned in the book, is when you have recommendation algorithms recommend to you, you know, what you should listen to or what kind of music you should listen to, what videos you should watch. If you have very narrow set of interests and the algorithm isn't careful, it can just show you just more and more of what you like. And so you go further and further down this tunnel. And maybe you're enjoying what you're seeing, but you don't know what else is out there. And so again, this narrow interest can become more narrow and could snowball out of control if the algorithms are not carefully designed.
And picking on that, Karthik, you talk about music and you take the example of three different approaches, right? One is you use the example of Pandora, which is about breaking down the characteristics of a song. The other is Last.fm, which is about recommendations based on people like you, what they've liked, and Spotify, which seems like seems to be a hybrid of the two. So as a consumer, how should we make choices in each of these paradigms? Maybe talk to us about how these systems work for a couple of minutes, and then I'd love your insights on what it means for the consumer for us to keep the broad interest going while leveraging the advantage of the algorithms.
Sure. Yeah, so the idea is, you know, how do we recommend good music to consumers? That's the question that Pandora is trying to answer, that Spotify is trying to answer, Amazon Music is trying to answer, all these platforms are trying to figure out how do we show music or play music that the user will like. Now, let's look at how humans would do it. If I had to recommend songs to you, Deepak, and you were to tell me that you like, let's say, Pashmina by Amit Trivedi, now I have to figure out what other songs to recommend to you. And it may be that I know the music well, and I know, okay, this is a certain kind of song. The music director is Amit Trivedi. There's a lot of musical orchestration or instrumentation in the music and so on. And I might recommend a song to you based on my knowledge of the music. I might find other songs that are similar. And so I might recommend, for example, let's say songs from Kai Poche to you, because it has similar instrumentation. It has, again, this Amit Trivedi style and so on. That's the approach that Pandora uses. Pandora essentially looks at music you like, looks at the musical attributes of those songs, attributes like, you know, how rhythmic is the music, how much instrumentation is in the music and so on. And it finds other similar songs to recommend. That's one way to do it. Now, suppose I didn't have a lot of knowledge of music. Suppose I don't know anything about the song Pashmina by Amit Trivedi. Then how do I recommend songs to you? One way I could do this is by asking my friends and asking which of you likes Pashmina. And say six or seven of them say, hey, I like Pashmina. Then I say, okay, what else do you like? And they say, well, we also like, I don't know, let's say a song by Arijit Singh. And then I say, okay, you know what? Among my friends who like Pashmina, a lot of them seem to like songs by Arijit Singh. So I'm going to recommend that to you. That's the Amazon Music approach. That's the approach that Last.fm also uses, which is essentially the people who like this also like this. That's the other way to recommend songs. And these are two ways to recommend music. And my research has shown that these simple algorithm choices have a huge impact on what kinds of music or products or movies or even news stories these algorithms expose us to. When you recommend songs based on, you know, people who like this also like this, it turns out that these kinds of designs have a bit of a popularity bias because they recommend stuff based on what others are consuming. So if there's a song that is perfect for you, Deepak, but not many other people are consuming it, then this design cannot recommend it to you because it relies on people who like this also like these other songs, and it requires other people to like it. And so it has a popularity bias. It cannot help expose you to these novel niche kinds of songs or indie music, indie bands, or even indie movies that might be perfect for you. The Pandora design recommends songs that are similar, but doesn't look at are others listening to it. And so it does not have that popularity bias. But the flip side is that it has no social component to it. And I think we all like, first of all, this idea that we are consuming songs that others are consuming. We also want to discuss the music with others. We also want to catch up with others and make sure we are listening to the kinds of music others are listening to. And so it doesn't have some of the social appeal of the Amazon-like design. And so the question is, can you combine the two in interesting ways? And Spotify does that today. Spotify actually started with the social design that Amazon has, which is people who listen to this also listen to these other songs. But they quickly realized that it has a popularity bias and they incorporated Pandora-like features. And that allows them now to recommend songs to you that you like, to recommend songs to you that have some social patterns to them, meaning others are consuming. But it also allows it to find songs that are perfect for you that others are not consuming. So it provides that balance. Netflix has done the same. When they originally launched their recommendation algorithm, it was completely social, like the Amazon approach. But now they have added the Pandora-like features. So now they're balancing the two. And so it's a good example of how, you know, even engineers need to think about algorithm design carefully because it has a big social impact. When you use these systems in music, in movies, or better yet, in news, it influences the kinds of things people get exposed to. So it's one thing to say, yes, it's showing people what they like, but you could also ask, is it showing people what they like and diversifying their tastes and allowing them to discover new interests, and it's allowing them to discover stuff that others aren't necessarily consuming? All those kinds of considerations might lead to a different design. And that's kind of the point I make there.
Got it. And I guess it's moving away from just efficiency to other elements as well, right? Which is possibly being lost in the narrative today in terms of what we need to think about as we use these machine intelligence related services or products.
Yeah, and that's a big message for consumers and to firms and to, you know, product designers, which is, I think that we shouldn't think of algorithms very narrowly in terms of, you know, there's one goal and is it improving that one goal? I think we need to think of these as parts of a social system with multiple goals. And so when you deploy a system, let's say for recruiting, we could ask, is it effective in finding people who we are likely to actually hire and promote? And that's a very important and probably the number one metric that firms should use. But it shouldn't be the only metric. We should also ask, you know, has it been tested for fairness? Does it have bias in some ways? We should also ask, you know, are there privacy implications? Are we looking at people's social media data without their consent when we are making recruiting decisions? And this, of course, happens a lot. Where sometimes our data, like our social media data, are used for recruiting or for, say, even loan approvals and so on, and we don't know about it. So what are the privacy implications? What are the implications with regard to safety and security? So I think we need to think of it more broadly as firms deploying these systems, but also as users who kind of say, okay, I'm willing to use this technology and be part of this because I know the company has done the right thing in terms of evaluating it more holistically.
Got it. And bringing it back to some of the use cases, Karthik, you talk about medicine as an application, and you talk about an exercise in Mount Sinai Hospital in New York,
mm-hmm.
where you talk about the algorithm being fed about 700,000 data points. And you go on to say that the algorithm did much better than humans in terms of diagnosing. I'm curious about the line between decision support versus decision making. How should leaders think about leveraging the power of algorithms, and where should they take it and run with it versus, you know, use the judgment on top of what the algorithms tell them?
Right. I think we're finding in many settings that algorithms can make as good and sometimes better decisions than humans. And so there is a temptation to make them autonomous, so to not use them for decision support, but essentially make them decision-making entities. Meaning, why bother having a human figure out, you know, who to invite for interviews, just have the system figure it out and maybe humans interview the applicants or something like that. And certainly you could ask in the medical setting as well. In fact, one of the godfathers of modern machine learning, his name is Jeff Hinton. He in fact got the Turing Prize this year, which is a top prize in computer science, sort of the Nobel Prize in computer science. He once made the statement that we can as well stop training radiologists because there's no point even having radiologists try to interpret X-rays and MRIs when machines can beat them easily. And so it's kind of arguing for not decision support, but decision making through algorithms. I think we need to be a little bit careful about that. I think AI has a lot to contribute when we are augmenting humans, when we are allowing humans to process more data than human brains can process, and machines become a way to augment human limitations and augment the human brain. And there are many settings where we want to actually replace humans with algorithms as well completely, and that's also fair. But I think when we get into socially consequential decisions, when we get into safety critical decisions, we need to be a bit careful and make sure there's a human in the loop. So I don't believe, for example, that, you know, even if a system is diagnosing better than doctors, you know, that you replace them. What you do is you use that to complement the doctor, to allow the doctor to be able to see more patients, to allow the doctor to be faster with the patients, to allow the doctor to say that I will focus, spend more time on the more complicated cases and the simple cases where it's just a fever, a viral cause, and you don't have to do much beyond just give a painkiller. You know, let the algorithm do some of that, or maybe use the algorithm to help a nurse do some of that, and things like that. So I think the goal shouldn't be, let's replace humans. The goal should be to figure out what are the things that are easy, and when things go wrong, the consequence isn't high, and therefore we completely automate that. What are the things that we automate for the human to free up their time to do the more creative things, to do the more complex cases. And then what are the things where we augment and guide the human and we kind of say, tell the doctor, we think it's the diagnosis is this and here's why, and then let the doctor make the call. Or we could say, you know, these systems are probabilistic. We could say, you know, 40% chance we think it's this, 30% chance we think it's that, 10% chance we think it's this, and here's why, and provide the explanations and the doctors make the decisions. So the goal, I think, should be in figuring out how we augment and not just replace.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. If I bring this back to the nature of work I do, I find that there are several psychometric tools that are now available in the context of assessing a leader. When I see people around me using just the psychometric as the sole data point in assessing a leader, I start getting concerned. I see too many people walking around with a hammer looking for a nail to hit. Let me give an example. I was talking to a CEO and a CHRO for a rapidly growing tech company on how they think about leadership transitions. When I asked them about how they'd done transitions before, they said that they would have had an incoming leader take a psychometric, get a coach to provide some feedback to the leader based on the psychometric for what he or she would have to do differently in the new role. And that was it. Couple of points to make here, right? One, I find just working with a psychometric as a characterization of the individual as a gross oversimplification and possibly even borderline insulting to the leader in question. Two, so much of the transition is contextual and a function of the people in the new organization, the culture, the business situation, and so on. I guess a similar logic applies when leaders are thinking about career paths. So much of the choice is contextual. What are you solving for? What gives you energy? What does your family want? What's the role of money? And so on and so forth. At best, some of these diagnostics can give you hypotheses to work with. The reason I mention it is that with machines getting good at probabilistic predictions, it's very easy to get into a mode of false confidence that we have the answer. Like Karthik says, I'd like to believe that there's an opportunity for humans to bring in empathy, an understanding of the nuanced context to provide augmented value based on what such tools provide us, rather than take the output of these tools literally. Let's now get back to the conversation with Karthik Hosanagar.
You know, when I read your book, to me personally, the most reassuring line in the book was on page 154. And there you talk about the categories of decisions for which you would prefer humans over algorithms. And you talk about, right on the top of the list, you talk about identifying new directions for your career as a key area where you'd want a human being on the other side. So that was, I must say, that was deeply reassuring for me personally, given the advisory I do.
Yes.
But taking a cue from that, I guess, the question I had was, given your research, what's your take on what kinds of jobs, careers are at risk due to evolution in AI? Which ones are AI-proof? And also, what are the new avenues that didn't exist earlier, but get created as a result of this movement?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's happening clearly with AI is the jobs that are risk are not just blue collar jobs or the labor intensive jobs, but all kinds of jobs that require thinking, white collar jobs, managerial jobs, and so on. I think the jobs that are at risk, certainly that involve simple number crunching, processing data in a very straightforward manner, I think those clearly are at risk. The things that go beyond number crunching, even things like, we were talking about medical diagnosis, but pretty much any job, any industry you look at, AI can automate a lot of things and do it better than humans. So I think there's a lot of jobs at risk. The way to think about it is that if there is something that is repetitive in nature and that is done by lots of people, then AI can automate that. Because if it's repetitive in nature and done by lots of people, then you can collect massive amounts of data on what they're doing and then use a machine to learn to do what they're doing. It's things that involve personal interaction, things that are not highly repetitive in nature, where there isn't that magnitude of data, things that are inherently somewhat creative in nature, that are highly personalized in nature, that are harder to do. And that's why I mentioned something like, say, my career switch or my career plans, because that is so individualized. It requires a careful focus on what is right for me, focusing on my own experiences. And it's not as simple as taking data on a million other people and saying that based on what's worked for a million people, here's what will work for you. Because I think there is so much of a very subjective, individual life satisfaction, job satisfaction aspect to it. And so it's hard to automate something like that. And so similarly, I mentioned, you know, a lot of what doctors do and nurses do is not just look at data and interpret the data and make decisions based on it, but it also includes things that involve empathy that ultimately assures a patient. And so I think the aspects of medicine that involve empathy are clearly protected from AI. So I think those are the kinds of things. And of course, you know, creating AI, you know, so far, you know, so if you look at data science, AI, you know, of course, these are going to be jobs of the future because it'll take a long time before AI can create AI. But for now, that's protected. But ultimately, I think of creativity, empathy, some of these softer skills will start to matter a lot more.
And bringing it back to education, Karthik, across levels, right? Whether it's primary or secondary or higher education, where do you see inadequate commentary, given what you're seeing, given the research you've done on AI? Where do you see, where do you get concerned when you look at the education system?
Well, I get concerned at all levels, whether you look at, you know, primary school, high school, even college. I think AI is improving at an exponential rate, and sometimes we are not good at understanding exponential change because we kind of look at where things are today. We kind of feel, hey, we have enough time. But the rate of change is exponential, and by the time you react 3 years later, it might be a bit late in for certain people and certain jobs. And so it's really important that we act super fast, that kids in school today grow up with things like algorithm literacy, so that not only the jobs, but as users of technology, they know how to use this. There are people coming out of colleges, out of high schools that are now going to be using systems like WhatsApp and TikTok and all these other social applications. And they have amazing potential, but these systems also can cause a lot of damage. I talked about fake news on WhatsApp, you know, serious damage if people don't understand how they work. So as part of, you know, we're talking about digital literacy, but we tend to think of it in terms of, you know, teaching them programming skills. I think that's great. Let's teach them programming because, you know, it'll be a very valuable skill going forward. But also let's teach them life skills for using technology, understanding how the technology works, what are its limitations, how does AI work. I think all that literacy is going to be important at all levels. It'll be even important, you know, I know a lot of your listeners are executives. Look at managers, look at CEOs. Most of the C-suite today doesn't understand what is AI. And they are now being tasked with leading AI-driven business transformation, using AI to come up with game-changing interfaces with consumers to change how they win over consumers. And most of them don't know what is AI, what is machine learning, or even basic analytics. And so how are they going to do that? So even at those levels, executives now need to be retrained with AI.
And maybe making it tactical, Karthik, if we take two types of people, right? One is leaders in companies, CEOs, CXOs. The other is, let's say, the common man on the street. For them to build a working appreciation of AI, what sorts of resources would you suggest, and how would you suggest that they go about doing it?
Well, so a selfish plug for my book, but the the point of this book, and I called it A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, to specifically bring up the point that this is meant for lay people. This is not an engineer's guide to AI. While engineers will get something out of it, this is meant to get, you know, regular people, whether it's the exec at a company or lay people understand how these systems work, what is at stake, why you need to pick up, and so on. But beyond that, I think it's important to further educate themselves, talking first about execs. You mentioned that group first. You know, I think the point is to have more training within the organization for executives and for middle managers and everyone in the organization to understand what is AI, what is it doing in different industries, a few case studies, and then having lots of internal discussions and debates on how your organization can use AI and benefit from it. I think that's certainly needed. And it requires maybe a decision up top to invest in this and create, as part of exec training, lots of programs for AI education for executives. And I think the other aspect of this is going to be, as you mentioned, for common man or for lay people, you know, how do they educate themselves? I think, again, there is no substitute to taking a few courses or reading a few books. And again, I'm not saying you need to get familiar with the intricacies of AI. You don't have to read the books meant for engineers, but I think you at least need to have a high level understanding. So go read a little bit about this, go attend a couple talks that might be offered, you know, at an educational institute that is open to the public. Things like that, I think, are going to be important.
Got it. Karthik, you talk about your chat with James Barat and him saying that AI has conquered all the games that need to be conquered and will soon be entering the world of reality next. You know, the next game is reality, sort of the tagline you use as you wrap up your book. How do you see the world play out in the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, so the context of that quote was that James, who's a well-known author and a documentary filmmaker, he wrote a book about AI and whether it poses an existential threat to humans. And we were having this conversation and we spent time talking about how AI has conquered various games. Of course, things like chess, but also in recent years, more complex games like Go and poker and so on. And so I posed the question, you know, so what game is next? And he kind of said, well, the next game is reality. And I think that's the way we should look at the next 5-10 years. We've had this fascination with AI, and lots of the media stories with AI over the last 10-15 years has been, you know, AI beats chess champion, AI beats Go champion, and so on. But I think now it's going to be AI replaces these jobs, and AI, you know, beats humans at these tasks and activities. Or also some problematic scenarios, such as a driverless car involved in this accident or that accident, or an autopilot system that failed and an airplane crashed, like we just had recently with the Boeing crash. And so I think we're going to see lots more of these kinds of things, and we should prepare for that. In terms of what the world looks like over the next 5-10 years, I think what excites me as far as AI over the next 5-10 years, there's really a long laundry list I have, but I'm going to pick two. One is driverless cars. I think the technology is advancing very rapidly. And even though we hear about the occasional crash, and we'll continue to hear about those crashes, you know, periodically it seems like these autonomous vehicles behave like drunk drivers. And they will happen, these kinds of incidents will happen. But in the end, they're going to be better than humans. And so we're going to see lots of these systems. In the next 5-10 years, we probably won't be able to walk into a car dealership and walk out with a driverless car. But I think we will see companies like Uber and others use these kinds of systems. It may be a while before driverless cars become a reality in India, but I wouldn't rule out that possibility as an impossible, because, you know, 10-15 years back, I was kind of thinking, you know, I don't know how Google Maps will ever figure out how to give driving directions in India. And it works reasonably and, in fact, quite well today. And I think same things will happen with driverless cars. We'll start to see it, I think, in more organized roadways, say in the US initially. But we'll also see it in China, where China is going to roll it out. And then from there, it'll also enter India. So that's one area. I think the other area is going to be medicine, I think, that excites me. There's a lot of interest in what is known as precision medicine, which is the idea of taking our personalized DNA profile, our microbiome profile, and so on, and personalizing treatment options. Imagine cancer treatment that is known to work for an individual's DNA profile, as opposed to saying, you know, we tried it on 100 people, it worked on 30, but it did not work on 70, so let's just try it on you. So instead of that, you could have more precisely targeted treatments. And I think that's another exciting thing. On the positive side, I think these are the ones that excite me. On the negative side, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have biases in AI. We've talked about autopilot systems failing. We've talked about autonomous vehicles crashing. And one that worries me a lot is fake news getting circulated on platforms like WhatsApp and others. So these are the worries. But I think overall, you know, if we put the right checks and balances in place, the value created will far, far exceed some of the risks that come up as well.
Got it. And just wrapping up, Karthik, as you know, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. And we've, during the conversation, we've spoken a lot about how the machines have gotten data and learned from humans and gotten smarter. But if I flip it around, how can we leverage the power of machines, or what can we learn, and how can we take advantages of where the machines are going and play to our potential? Where's the opportunity?
Yeah, I think my whole thesis is around augmented intelligence. So it's around, you know, let's get tech savvy. Let's start using more and more of these systems. Let's understand how they work. Let's understand when they work well, when they don't work as well, and use them to guide our decisions and use them to augment our intelligence. And I think that's the way forward, whether it's a doctor kind of saying, should I be using an AI system that my hospital is considering bringing in? And in fact, in India itself, there are hospitals that have started trialing some of these systems, like the IBM Watson healthcare system and many more, or, you know, lawyers using these systems, or you have marketing people using AI recommendations for ad design, for bidding in ad auctions on Facebook and so on, creative professionals and so on. And I think the goal at the end of the day should be, you know, oftentimes we think about what's our secret sauce, what gives us competitive edge over other competitors, which usually we tend to think of as human competitors. But I think we should also think about what gives us a competitive edge over machines. And I think those are skills like creativity, empathy, social skills and knowledge. And I think we should invest in some of those skills, which ultimately will allow us to do better. And of course, also the technical skills to be able to use these machines. I think that's the combination that we should look for.
Got it. Karthik, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time, and good luck with the book launch in India.
Deepak, thanks for having me again on the show. And it's been a fun, informative conversation for me as before as well. So thanks for having me.
Hope you found the conversation purposeful. I was talking to the principal of the school where my children study. It's an IB school in Mumbai in India. And I happened to ask the principal his views on what we should be solving for in equipping the kids for the future. He very lucidly responded saying, we should be equipping our kids with two things for them to be relevant. One, critical thinking, and two, empathy. While empathy is well understood, he went on to expand on what he meant when he said critical thinking. He went on to say that critical thinking is not just the ability to crunch data or analytical horsepower as we understand it. It's possibly the ability to find patterns across disciplines and connect the dots, the ability to observe how different parts of a system interact with each other and the interdependency between the various elements. It's also the ability to frame the right questions that we need to think about and solve. That would be more important than knowing the answers. The world of the future will be an interesting one indeed, to put it very mildly. It's going to cause a lot of anxiety to a lot of people, but at the same time, I feel if we are willing to be agile and open ourselves to new experiences and learning, I don't think we've had a more exciting time than now from that perspective, in terms of the number of possibilities that open up. Thank you for listening. The next guest on the podcast is Michael Watkins. a professor of leadership and organizational change at IMD Lausanne in Switzerland, and considered one of the leading thinkers in the field of accelerating leadership transitions. We spent time talking about insights from his recently launched book, Master Your Next Move, where he talks about different types of leadership transitions and what CEOs and CXOs need to bear in mind as they move from one context to another.
And one easy way to set people up to fail is to bring them into an organization as, in quotes, a change agent, when there isn't really, you know, consensus that change is necessary. I my little jokes about this again, right? So, you know, organization decides at some level, intellectually, to your point, not emotionally necessarily, that change is necessary. So they hire a change agent, and the person comes in, and oh my goodness, they start trying to change things. You know, like, oops, you know, like, we weren't expecting this, you know, like, you know, so, and then, you know, the reaction begins. So I guess that's the essence of the advice, you know, but it is a trade-off, right? Because the other thing is, you stay too long operating by the way the organization operates, the risk is you won't really drive the kind of change that's necessary.
And maybe just trying to map it to a time clock, have you noticed any trends in terms of, leaders moving from observe and assimilate mode to taking calls mode? Is it 90 days, or is it 6 months? Do you have?
You know, it's funny you said that, Greg, because I actually have never asked that question, Deepak, and it's such an interesting question. And 6 months just flashed into my mind. I can't tell you why I think that, right? But what I can tell you is 3 months doesn't seem like enough time.
Look out for this podcast episode. We should be publishing this in the next couple of weeks. For more content, please visit playtopotential.com, where you have content organized by speakers and by specific sub-themes around leadership, transitions, and careers. The curated playlist section enables you to scroll content across speakers by a specific theme that's top of mind for you. If you want to listen offline, the content is available on most podcast platforms like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Thank you for listening. Bye now.